This is file 54. This is 94. This is Gene McMillan, and I am interviewing Mr. Skip Barber of the Lime Rock Racetrack. Today's date is April 22nd, and we're going to start with a little genealogical information, and then he's going to tell me about the racetrack. What is your name?
My name is Skip Barber.
And when were you born?
In November of 1936.
And that was the 16th?
Yes.
Your birthplace?
Philadelphia.
And when did you first come to this area?
I first came to this area when I came to my first race at Lime Rock, which I came to drive in. I had just started racing, and I think that was 1959.
And what was the car that you were using?
And I was using an Austin Healey Sprite.
Lovely car. Lovely car. Which came first, buying the racetrack or your racing school?
The racing school started running here in 1975. I bought the racetrack with a group of five other guys, in 1983.
And what did you teach at your driving school? Was it just like you do now with snow skidding, or what were you teaching when you started?
For the first few years, we did racing schools only, in single-seater cars called Formula Fords. And the racing school worked for people that didn't want to go racing, just wanted to be better drivers. Mm-hmm. It turns out that the skills that make you a good race driver make you a safer, better driver on the street. Not to go fast on the street.
Mm-hmm. But safer.
I mean, a good race driver can slow the car down in a really short distance. He goes around the racetrack faster that way. He goes further at full throttle before he puts on the brakes because he's so good with the brakes. Those same braking skills are what you need, you know, when the baby carriage gets pushed in front of you.
True. Or the little old lady with the walker.
Right. So it really turned out that was okay for people who just wanted to be better on the street. But 4 or 5 years after the racing school started, we started a driving school component.
And you've added winter driving now, haven't you?
We've added winter driving just this year.
Ooh.
And that's a track function, not a school function. I don't own the school anymore. I sold that 14 years ago. We made snow this winter for the first time.
That must have been interesting.
Well, it was great, but kind of all the winners that decide to make your own snow.
Mother Nature didn't cooperate.
Over-cooperated.
Now, I would assume that with your driving school and your racing school, there would be a certain age where the reflexes would be maximum.
I don't know if that's true or not.
Really?
They're good at 13, and they're... No, I don't think that's true.
Okay.
If it's true, I don't know it. Certainly
okay.
Couldn't tell it.
Good. Good point. Because I do the 55 drive alive, and the reaction time is slower for somebody my age than when I was 16.
Oh, for sure.
But if you've got those skills, you still know how to compensate.
Well, when you asked the question, I wasn't thinking in terms of, say, people in their 70s or 80s. Actually, the first racing school we ever did, we had a guy 75 years old in it.
Ooh.
And he happened to be just fine. Mm-hmm. But of course, your reflexes get worse. No question.
Age,
but it doesn't happen at the same time for everybody.
No, it doesn't. Now, when you were working with the racing school, you were a teacher at that point.
I started as not only a instructor, but the instructor. Yes.
But you found that your strengths were in other areas. And what were your strengths?
Well, I discovered, you know, I never expected to the racing school to ever amount to much. I was treating it almost as if it was a hobby. But I learned in the first year that I loved dealing with the logistics, problem solving, which of course
analytical
is what
mind.
Generally business is, and mm-hmm. driving a race car is problem solving that just happens real fast.
Yes.
So I didn't spend a lot of time as an instructor. I spent it more as an organizer.
Good. How long did you keep the racing school? From you said you started it in 75 and you sold it 14 years ago. So you've had it
25 years.
And you bought the Lime Rock Racetrack in 1983.
83.
Who did you buy it from?
I bought it.
You and the other men.
My group, yeah.
Yeah.
I brought it from a guy who was a Greek ship owner named Harry Theodorakopoulos. I can't spell it. It'll be in the book.
Thank you.
He had raced mm-hmm. as an amateur, and by 1983 he had lost interest and wasn't racing anymore. And, you know, wanted to do other things.
Everybody does. What's the size and acreage of the park?
It's roughly 360 acres.
That's a lot of property. And I'm assuming that you manage all of it, whether it's the physical track part of it or whether it's woodlands or wetlands or whatever.
Yes. There is a significant chunk of it that's woodlands mm-hmm. and wetlands.
And you had a consortium of five other people with yourself.
Right. I put together a group to buy the track. I was worried about the prospects of other people who wanted to buy it. They didn't want to convert it to something else, mm-hmm. but I thought they might not be very successful running it. For example, one of them wanted to build a big hotel here, not instead of the racetrack, but to benefit from the racetrack patrons. Will you try building a big hotel in this? And what happens in the winter? Not a good idea.
No.
And I saw that. So anyhow, I put together a group of people I knew who mm-hmm. raced in the school race series, or who I knew from other racing. Ways.
So it was racing people that knew about racing and knew some of the ins and outs of possible problems.
Yeah, and anticipated enjoying the whole process, mm-hmm. and it worked out that way. We borrowed all the money. None of us had any money. And each guy's obligation was to make two mortgage payments a year. And that was how the track, you know, could reinvest in itself mm-hmm. without having to serve the debt.
And it's been developed over the years in as what you're doing now. What are some of the things that you developed as far as the infrastructure or whatever?
Well, it turned out when we bought it, we discovered that the infrastructure was completely used up. I mean, I think the first time we turned an electric switch on, it cost $30,000 in 1983 money.
Good gosh.
For electrical services, and the same thing with turning on a faucet and on. It was a great lesson in pouring money into the ground.
Like building
literally.
A house.
Yeah. Well, no, you have a house to look at when you're done. When you pour it, you put it underground and electricity and water, you see nothing.
Yeah.
We built some buildings early on. We just steadily worked away at it. The two most significant things we did was in 2008, we not only repaved the whole track, but we dug up much of it, which didn't have a proper base, and put a proper highway standard base under it. And then this winter, 2014-15 winter, we've addressed a lot of the infrastructure. You know, there's a common quote about Lime Rock. There's a website called Jalopnik, which is not famous but extremely popular in automotive and racing circles. Actually, one of the most visited websites in the world. And they last year said Lime Rock's the most beautiful track in North America, fifth most beautiful in the world. But they were kind enough not to say, but all the infrastructure's prehistoric, which is true. And this winter, we're addressing that. Better sight lines for spectators, bigger spectator areas, flatter, better areas for hospitality tents. Lots of new trees.
Oh, good.
Well, we've done that pretty regularly. We had a tree drive 2 years ago. We raised money for 55. That was on our 55th anniversary. We, Lime Rock fans, bought 55 trees. All, each one individually in memory of somebody.
Yep. Oh, I wish I'd known.
I mean, it was really neat. We,
oh, yeah.
People celebrating anniversaries, a lot of them in memory of.
I have two trees in my backyard in memory of my husband.
It's... Yeah.
And then I got a little annoyed, so I planted a tree for me. Equal opportunity.
Getting a jump.
Getting a jump on whatever happens.
Right.
Have you made an application for the National Register list?
We're on the National Register.
You are on the National Register list. Isn't that unusual?
Well, I think most of the town of Salisbury is, and the center of Lime Rock Village is. What we have made an application for is... historical landmark, and that's extraordinarily unusual.
Yes. And is that because of John Fitch's
nothing
things?
To do? No.
All right.
No.
What's the
historical? Qualifications are that something significant has to have happened at the place, and the most important road race, that's the kind of racing we do, probably ever in this country was here. That was the first time that amateurs and professionals and IndyCar drivers all competed in a major race. You probably don't remember, but when I was a little boy, certainly in the 50s, 60s, amateurs didn't do things with professionals.
No, they didn't.
I mean, great tennis players were no longer allowed to play major tennis events because they dared. Well, we broke that rule.
And
racing has sanctioning bodies just like tennis and every other sport. We didn't do this with a sanction. Lime Rock did it on its own.
That is significant.
Had this race. It was a big,
big deal.
Deal.
Really big deal.
And it was a further big deal. You know, sports car people were snobbish. And some Indianapolis driver won the race in a 10-year-old midget racer. And he beat the best sports car in the world. A very good estimate. You're not supposed to be able to do that.
No. Oh, that's neat.
They apparently... He wore the brakes out in practice, and they had brake drums that they relined at a gas station in Lakeville. And came back and won the race. I wish I'd been here. There must have been a lot of long faces.
Yeah.
Turns out he was a wonderful guy. His name was Roger Ward, and he did win the Indianapolis. And that same year... And he thought that this was the most significant race of his life.
I can see where it would be.
That.
Yeah, I can see where it would be. Oh, that's
so
wonderful.
I've lost. National. historic landmark you were talking about.
Yeah.
So something significant has to have happened.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have been, it has to be the same facility it was
then,
50 years ago or then or when it was built, and our track has not changed at all. I mean,
the track is the same.
The part you drive on is exactly the same. The feel of the place is exactly the same.
Which is bucolic and beautiful.
Yeah, and a guy, it turns out there's a guy in Washington who's very involved in this, who went to Trinity College and was a Lime Rock fan then, and he came and checked and said, ooh, same place.
Oh, good. Validation.
Yeah, despite all the money we've spent underground.
But it doesn't show.
No, that is correct.
You know, it's like putting French drains around my house. It doesn't show until we have a flood, and then the water doesn't come in the cellar.
Right, and I think when we finish all this earth moving, it's not going to show.
No, no.
You're not going to realize you're standing 3 feet higher looking at a corner.
Yeah.
You're not going to realize that you can see a little further around the corner. Uh-huh. Hopefully nobody's going to realize that.
Well, I won't tell. Now, you must have a staff that...
Oh, we have a terrific staff. We have a terrific staff.
Oh, good.
You asked me before how big it was, and I didn't know. We have a bit over 20 full-time people, and, of course, many more seasonal people, and then many, many more on major events.
Yeah, like the Rotary used to come and volunteer and pass out programs and so forth. What is an engineered track?
That's another the teeny component of the landmark. This is the first track that had any engineering design with an effort to make it safe. They were early days of the interstate highway system, and people were getting interested in road design, and there were engineers at a place called Cornell, Aeronautical Labs at Cornell, who also were racing fans, in fact raced, and they got involved. Jim Vail first drove his, you know, kind of designed it with his bulldozer, driving around his now not functioning gravel pit.
Mm-hmm.
After all the gravel was gone.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that.
And then a guy named Bill Milliken.
Oh, yeah.
Who I think was a professor at Cornell. And a race driver got real involved in the cambers of the corners and very specifically the angles, of the layout of the corners. That's not a big deal, but it's interesting.
But it is, because it's designing something to be safe and not just nothing.
Correct.
All right. You can tell I know an awful lot about this. What's the difference between a road race and an oval race?
Road racing tracks, which this is obviously one, have both right and left-hand corners and have elevation changes. They go uphill and downhill sometimes.
Oh.
Ovals are just that.
Flat. Like horse racing.
Well, not necessarily flat, but they're oval shape. You turn one direction, always left.
Like horse racing?
Yeah, well, good question. When automobile racing started, it started in Europe, which is where the very first cars were built, and they raced on public roads. And then when it was time to get off of public roads onto tracks, they built racetracks that simulated public roads. When car racing started in America, and we had lots of county fairgrounds, which had oval horse racing tracks.
Great Barrington Municipal.
We raced on the dirt ovals, and that's where it started.
Okay.
And that's just gone on that way forever. There are almost no ovals in Europe. I think one, two actually, and not so many road courses in North America compared to Europe.
I'm thinking of the Cheltenham racetrack, and I think that's an oval, but I wouldn't want to switch.
In England?
Yeah.
No.
No?
Guy who works for me used to be a steeplechase rider there.
Okay.
And before he became a car racer, that's jumping.
Oh, I know what steeplechasing is, yeah.
Well, maybe it does a loop.
It
but
does.
But it's not round and round.
Okay, it does a loop. All right. Okay.
On an oval race, you know, you do many laps.
Sure. Okay. I learn something all the time. Who owns the racetrack now? Do you own it by yourself?
Yes, I own it by myself.
And what was the name of that website that you said is so popular?
Chalopnik.
Do you know how to spell it?
There's somebody in the office.
Okay, I can do that. John Fitch. What can you tell me about John Fitch and his association?
Well, John is often called the designer or creator of Lime Rock, and that's not really accurate. He was very involved.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe he came in the picture after Jim Vale had kind of bulldozed the basic course. John brought in the engineering component. He brought in Cornell and was absolutely influential in that. And John was an early manager of the racetrack.
Oh.
And it was John who put on, promoted, organized that major road race that was so significant. He moved to this area because of Lime Rock. I think he lived in Stamford. And came here and never left.
Did he develop his safety barriers?
John developed his safety barriers here, yes. We've got great pictures of him crashing a station wagon down at the end of the straightaway. I mean, crashing into barriers.
What haven't I asked you that I should ask you about either your racing school or your track?
Well, you haven't asked anything about economic impact on the community.
That's fine. Let's go for economic impact.
And
because it has a great impact.
It has a huge impact, but I could only answer that question anecdotally.
That's fine.
We haven't had, years ago we had a economic impact study done, but that's so long ago that, one, I don't remember any numbers, but so many restaurant owners and most of the hotel owners have all said to me they would not be in business. You know, if Lime Rock ever closed, they'd be gone. And I think that's true.
Because the schools are out during the summer, so you don't have the competition between getting a room because you're going to the track, getting a room because you're a Hotchkiss parent or
right.
Salisbury school.
Well, we certainly have a much greater impact than Hotchkiss.
Oh, yes. You have a much
restaurants
you have that. A much bigger catchment area of people that
right,
come.
Right, right. You know, if you needed a story, I was surprised. This year, 2014, Lime Rock had less major events than it traditionally does, for all kinds of reasons. And a guy who owns a very good restaurant in Great Barrington said to me, I'm going to lose money this year, and it's your fault. Great Barrington.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, no, I believe it. But
yeah,
but
it's only 20 miles away.
Yeah. If you ask planning and zoning, they wouldn't believe it. The impact is not just the obvious restaurant and hotels. I mean, I've had antique dealers tell me that common thing. A guy comes to the racing school and he brings his wife or girlfriend.
And she does
she
the
goes
shops.
Shopping.
She goes shopping, sure. When Foster would go to train shows in York, Grace and I would go shopping.
Yeah.
Makes sense. Mean, we'd have lunch out, we'd go shopping.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And that's what ladies do.
Yeah.
You have had events like the Classic Car weekend, Labor Day weekend, and you have had other special events other than racing here.
We had this past year a wonderful event to benefit an AARP charity called the Drive to End Hunger, and we raised over $100,000. And on the 4th of July weekend before the fireworks, we packed, I think, 100,000 meals. I have to get you the right number. It was huge.
Wow.
All done by volunteers. I mean, we raised the money to buy the food.
Mm-hmm.
Had a lot of cooperation from LeBuns.
They're wonderful.
Bob LeBun.
Really, yeah, he's very much, very much.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And we had a stock car driver who's very popular named Jeff Gordon came in the fall, and we sold rides around the racetrack with him. And
oh, lovely.
Attendance at a dinner with him, and obviously autograph sessions, and we raised a lot of money that day. And some guy from Millerton gave us an anonymous $100,000 gift. No. An anonymous $10,000. Did he give us $100,000? He gave us $100,000. I'll have to find that out too.
Wonderful.
It was a huge number, and we raised $100,000. So overall,
matching
we
funds.
Raised $200,000. I'll ask that when we're done.
But
that's a special kind of event. Yeah,
but that's wonderful because it benefits so many other people than just race car people.
We were able to stipulate that all that money and all that food go to Litchfield County, Southern Berkshire County, and Eastern Dutchess County. I don't even know if those food banks all realize where a lot of their food
but they were
came
very
from
grateful.
This year, but that's
they were very
from.
Grateful. Absolutely.
We did it through the Connecticut Food Bank, which is a good organization. We had a concert here for Tri-Arts. Now the
yes.
Sharon Playhouse again. We've done things like that.
Yeah.
Sharon Hospital, before it became a for-profit, used to have benefits here. There have been a lot of
yeah,
things
I think
like
I remember
that.
Some of those.
A long time ago.
Anything?
The community mental health, what were they called?
Oh.
They came here on and off.
It's fascinating when I came with a perception of one small thing and how you have broadened my horizons as to all of the wonderful things that you do for the community.
I think that's true. I don't think generally people know about that.
But this is why we're doing the interview, so that people do know.
But we do a bunch of things every year.
Mm-hmm.
It varies year to year.
Sure. And, of course, the fireworks are always popular.
Yeah, and that's on us. The Rotary...
The Rotary buys the fireworks.
Buys the fireworks and collects the money.
Yep.
We do everything else.
You do the setups?
We do everything. We don't get... I mean, we don't... You know, we pick up the trash. We don't get.
But who, I mean, you have a professional group that comes in and actually sets
yeah,
off.
Yeah, Rotary yep. hires a group, I think, yep. from Long Island to yep. shoot off the firearm. You got to be licensed to do that. But as Rotarians have gotten older, we've assumed more of those. That's really sad what's happened to Rotary. It's really small now. It's
oh, I know.
Nothing like the group that
was. Well, when Foster was in it in 1976 until he died in 2005, and we used to go to the Rotary dinners, and it would be 50, 60, 80 people. And I've now spoken to the Rotary twice, and there's 18. I have school classes bigger than that.
We had Rotary yesterday. I went, I don't go often, and we had a really good guest speaker, and I felt for the guy. We certainly didn't have 20.
You know, I'm a local. It doesn't make any difference whether I speak to 2 or 22. But when somebody's come a distance, you really like to have a big audience, and that's...
You feel terrible.
Yeah. But it's like a lot of the organizations now, the senior members are getting tired. And it's the new blood is too busy, not interested, whatever, and they just don't join these organizations as they used to, which is a shame.
Yeah, and that, of course, is Rotary's problem. It's everybody's problem.
Oh, yeah, whether it's Rotary or DAR or book club or churches.
Ooh, boy, Protestant church, all churches.
All churches. The Fall Festival. Back in the 50s, it was a really, really big deal. And this past year, fewer of the churches are participating because the members are tired.
Yeah, service clubs like Rotary, that's the only one I know.
And Kiwanis.
Yeah. The Salisbury Rotary doesn't have a future. I mean, it's been around a long time.
It has.
And every year there are less people there. I mean, mm-hmm. somebody dies and they don't get replaced,
yeah.
let alone any chance of growth. I mean,
yeah.
it's really
And there's a
sad.
Lot of, with the volunteers, there's a lot of work that they used to do. People don't have the time anymore.
Yeah.
Which is... It's sad, but but like everything else, it's a cycle. It'll go around again. It always does.
Well, don't be sure. As the historian, you know that the population of these towns was double in the late 1800s what it is now.
Oh, well, yes, and there was work then.
Yeah. Well,
there's no work
what's
now.
What's the work going to be 25 years from now?
I don't have any clue.
And
but the racetrack will still be here.
Probably. But where are people with a really modest income going to live? I mean,
oh, I know.
This is a...
It's hard.
Not,
it's hard on
it's
ordinary
not a
people.
Picture. And the resistance.
Well, I'm an optimist. There is going to be a silver lining someplace.
I live in Sharon, and there's a road very near my house that where most of the houses, many of them must have been built almost as beach cottages,
mm-hmm.
near Mudge Pond,
yep.
not right on it, but near it.
Yep.
Well, a couple of them are on it. But,
yep.
And certainly in Sharon, it's got to be the road that has the least expensive houses on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on a tour by the being driven around by an affordable housing group in Sharon 5 years ago. And I said, you know, if I ever had the money, you know, when the day comes that I sell the racetrack or part of the racetrack, I could see slowly buying all those houses and having that become affordable housing in Sharon, you know, fixing
mm-hmm.
those places up. And the woman who was horrified at the idea that there might be a street where all those people would live. And she was
Why not?
Part of the
Why not? They've got to live somewhere.
Well, it's the old not next door. It's a great concept, but don't do it next to my house.
But they're all working people.
You don't defend it to me. I mean, I was the guy that wanted to do it, if ever possible, but I was shocked. I mean, there's somebody that you would think would be for it, as opposed to the people that you know are going to be against it.
Oh, what? Well, people are different.
But you need them to cut your grass.
Well, this is
plow the snow. You just don't need them to live near you. It's unbelievable. Anyhow.
Oh, fooey. Is there anything else that you want to add?
No, I was going to find out about the...
Okay.
I know it's $200,000, but let me just...
I'm going to say thank you very much.